I'm Christopher Lydon with the teacher and close reader of the best American journalism, Jay Rosen, of New York University and the professional clubhouse online, Press Think. We're talking about the changing forms and substance of the American public conversation in this presidential campaign year of 2012. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Jay Rosen, well do I remember you telling me nearly 10 years ago at the rosy dawn of the blogging era that terms of authority are changing, meaning that the old gatekeepers of news and opinion in this country were going down for the count. We've seen the damage to newspapers and television networks. Sometimes we've celebrated it. And we've seen and heard the sprouts of new energy on the web. What interests me is the overall conversation, the consciousness in this country that media, after all, is supposed to serve. What's the Jay Rosen big picture of where we're at?
Well, when I first said that we were getting used to new entrants into the media system and a more participatory press. And now I think what strikes me looking at 2012, the election campaign, the press, the political conversation, is how things don't connect anymore. You have the Washington classes, what they do kind of exists in its own separate reality. You have the campaign that's out there, which is this traveling bubble that goes around from city to city, but it doesn't really connect with people's lives. And you have the same sort of journalism. The campaign journalism actually isn't all that much different from 1972 and Boys in the Bus, in which you're a character. And it seems to be sort of separated from reality in a lot of ways. If I have one impression, it's that these things that are supposed to be helping us make sense of the world kind of stand in their own spheres. And they don't connect. So, for example, this week, Obama goes to the American Society of Newspaper Editors annual convention, which is sort of like Meet the Press, right? And he says to them in a very pointed way, you know, you've developed this thing, this false equivalence pattern, in which you say that since the two sides can't agree, they must be equally at fault, and the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. And this came in response to a question in which somebody in the American Society of Newspaper Editors said, you know, Republicans are criticizing you, you're criticizing Republicans. What do you say to Americans who just want you to get along and solve problems, right? So Obama shows his impatience with this, and he calls them out for this pattern of false equivalence and the truth lies somewhere in the middle and both sides are equally wrong. And he sort of says, you know, that's really lame. And I look for a single political reporter, a political journalist, producer of political television to take this on and comment and respond or even notice that he said it. Utter silence. It's like he was speaking into a void. So that's what I mean. It's like that's, you know, there's a conversation to be had there. It's not joined. We go on to the next thing. And, you know, there's reasons for that. You know, the very pattern that he was trying to point out is meant to advertise how the press doesn't have a stake. It doesn't have a side. It's suspicious of the Republicans. It's suspicious of the Democrats. So to listen to Obama's criticism and take it seriously would actually defeat the purpose of false balance and phony symmetry. So the pattern instructs you in how to ignore criticism of the pattern. So that's like what we have now. We have these conversations that don't connect.
Back in the dawn of our conversation, Jay, I mean, the hope was that the web and blogging and new voices, individual voices, self-reliant voices, in the Emersonian tradition, if I may say, were going to ventilate a conversation around Iraq, the war that the American press completely swallowed whole, and we were just beginning to see the consequences. So we thought it was a political opportunity to change the conversation. But you're reminding me of also of Joan Didion's line, I think it was 1988, when she, you know, took a look at the press and probably went to the news editors conference but said, I cannot find a connection between the chattering class and the life of the country, which is pretty much what you're saying. What has been the digital effect? All that hope we invested in, you know, the unedited voices of individual people.
In a lot of ways, that did happen. I mean, we have a very different situation today. We have people who are not as dependent on big media as they were. It is more possible for people to have their own voices. They listen to each other much more than they listen to the authorities today. If you look at the way that horizontal social networks work, people are much more likely now to find news and pay attention to events because their friends and people they know recommended it than they are to just sit at the feet of the gods of news. And you have a huge growth in niche publishing, niche journalism, so that people who want way more than they ever got from the old press on important topics actually get it. It's long-form journalism is experiencing a rebirth. Specialized sites are much easier to get into business and to find. There's more information about things that people care about. It's that the connections among all this more and the basic instruments of accountability in politics and journalism are weaker because there has been, in a way, a decentralizing, an unbundling, and a opening to participation.
There is a huge new cast of political journalists online. Think of Joshua Michael Marshall, Talking Points Memo, The Daily Kos, Truth Dig, Truth Out, all sorts of people writing. I was fascinated, just as a little detail, Robert Scheer, who made a big deal of breaking with Obama. He's not our guy anymore.
Right.
Today is saying, no, we're going to have to go with Obama wholeheartedly in a contest with Mitt Romney. And he's being trashed by the people that he's trained to think untruth-dig. I mean, so there's a lot of life back and forth and turbulence out there. Question is, why hasn't it changed the conversation in the country, or say in the Republican debates, or in these confrontations emerging now between Romney and Obama?
I think that's one of the biggest mysteries in politics now. I mean, I think what is called the increasing partisan divide or the polarization of politics is actually something else. I think our language for it is really weak. The political interpreters on television who talk about it haven't figured out how to talk about it. And so what I see, and I'm aware that this interpretation itself gets classified as part of the partisan divide, but what I see is that old line from 2004 about the reality-based community was the start of a description of our current situation that I can recognize. And what that critique said is that the Republican Party, for reasons that I think no historian or political scientist has tried to explain, found more political traction in a kind of flight from empiricism, from reality, from reason given. It's only a part of the party. It's like it's a wing. But the empiricists in the party haven't tried to stop it. This is sometimes described as going to the right. I don't think it has anything to do with a drift to the right. Whatever kept both political parties in some sort of normal range of contact with reality, never perfect, often filled with distortion, propaganda, selective memory, best case scenarios, where was he thinking? There's always huge amounts of political distortion in the system in both parties. But somehow, and I don't know how it happened, the Republican Party just broke away from the normal constraints. Iraq had something to do with it, changing nature, the internal dynamics, maybe that has something to do with it. Media system probably has something to do with it. We have all these institutions that essentially break if that fact is admitted. Mainstream political journalism breaks if you acknowledge that one of the two major parties isn't as reality-based as it was. Congress breaks. The think tanks break. And none of them want to break. And so they have to keep redescribing the situation in terms that we recognize, like bitter partisanship. And so there are people who kind of like sort of know this is going on. We sort of talk about it sometimes. But in reality, we're just still protected from it.
That sounds important to me, Jay, but I want to take it one step further. It seems to me the empiricists in the press, and we are as reporters, I mean, that's what we do, is, you know, count the wounded or the driven outs, or the empiricists in the press have sort of gone to sleep. And my case in point is simply, what do we really know about the discontent in the country? What are we prepared to say about it? Specifically, you know, we put labels on it like the Tea Party or Occupy, which are presumed to stand for right against the left, but we've heard very little, sorted very little about the deeper things. We haven't put them on the couch or even sort of gone into their houses to know, to sort out the real from the unreal, the economic from the spiritual, et cetera, et cetera. We're groping. Yeah. It's the press that seems to have accepted these labels as somehow instructive.
Well, the press speaking for a class of interpreters in the Washington political culture that is larger than the press. It's also the people mm-hmm. in the think tanks. It's yeah. the people who are on staff in Congress. It's the permanent government, as who was it? Sidney Blumenthal said, or the permanent campaign, right? The people who day in, day out, year in, year out, invent the narrative of public life. That's what Joan Didion said, right? These are the people who are on the bus. They are there at the Washington breakfasts. They appear on C-SPAN. They show up at American Enterprise Institute. Right? And so that class, of which the press is one component, has an unrecognized investment, interpretive schemes that right. were broken in half by the Republican Party. And they don't want those things to break because many other things go with them. And so what is now called by a lot of people who recognize it, false balance, I call it fake symmetry, is not just sort of a bad habit that some news writers got into. It's a survival strategy.
Survival strategy for the very people that we know are the problem. I mean, it's yes. corporatized, 1%, privileged, et cetera, et cetera. Let me just confess, I'm sort of in the spell of Tony Jutt's last sort of biblical prophecy warning as he was dying. He wrote this book called Ill Fares the Land, but it seems to me he's a voice in my head now of precisely what we're missing in this public conversation. Tony Jutt, European historian, your colleague at New York University, prolific essayist in the New York Review of Books, who died almost 2 years ago of Lou Gehrig's disease. But in his last days, he was reduced to a whisper, but it was so powerful.
On fire,
yeah. Here's a fragment, but I think this, in a certain sense, could be a manifesto for the Tea Party. It could be a manifesto for Occupy. It could be a main theme of the 2012 campaign. And it's very, very simple. Here's a piece of it. We in the West have lived through a long era of stability, cocooned in the illusion of indefinite economic improvement. But all that is now behind us. For the foreseeable future, we shall be deeply economically insecure. We are assuredly less confident of our collective purposes, our environmental well-being, or our personal safety than at any time since World War II. We have no idea what sort of world our children will inherit, but we can no longer delude ourselves into supposing that it must resemble our own. I think we all say, yes, Tony, it's true. It's true in my family. It's true with the people across the street. Republicans or Democrats. It has nothing to do with partisanship. It has to do with the sort of trends that historians follow and economists of the grandest scope. But it's part of his complaint against what he calls our dilapidated public conversation, that we're not talking about it. And if you were labeled a declinist in the Republican primary, you're dead. You're dead, right. Bro. You don't believe in the dream? It's morning in America. You don't believe it's morning in America or mid-morning or something? The barriers are up against this sort of simple declaration that we all agree with.
I think that's true. It's impossible to register in our public conversation an America in decline, a loss of confidence. We also haven't dealt with the huge crisis of accountability. Nobody is accountable for anything in this country. Who's accountable for a phony case for war put forward in 2002 and 2001? Nobody. Who's accountable for a financial crash that and corrupt financial practices that went on for years and made lots of people rich? Nobody. Who's accountable for failing to detect a phony case for war in the press? Nobody. Just to take an example, David Gregory, to this day, maintains that he and his colleagues reporting on the White House and the Bush administration did a great job in the run-up to the war. He says this today. His reward for that is not to be laughed out of the profession, but to get Tim Russert's chair on Meet the Press. He's bigger than ever. To me, that just that little story tells the tale of accountability in the United States. It's that group of people that still has a hold of the political conversation, even though fewer people believe them or pay attention to them or rely on them. And so the alternative to a more reality-based politics, which we do not have yet, is just a huge increase in cynicism everywhere.
Well, and Occupy and Tea Party can match each other's righteous anger about exactly that point. I mean, talk about unaccountability. I think if a Martian who hadn't been here for 10, 15 years came back to Earth and saw after the Iraq War, you're still reading Tom Friedman? Are you kidding? Mm. You're still reading Andrew Sullivan? These people were massively, lethally wrong about the biggest blunder in our history. Mm. And they're still prattling on. Andrew Sullivan, to his credit, has pulled back his horns. Tom Friedman has, you know, talks about greening of everything, but just to change the subject. Bill Keller, executive editor during that time, wrote a, to my mind, hugely interesting confession of how he got it wrong. I mean, he went through all the simple stages of thinking about his daughter, getting interested in Iraq, worrying about Israel, forming a community in his mind of other people like Mike Ignatieff and Andrew Sullivan, who were just as wrong as he was. And he staggered on into that awful, awful waste of a decade. And he's still writing in the New York Times. How different would it be if you had to not just confess, but pay up? And or if we had malpractice suits in journalism.
Or if we had the equivalent of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Amen.
You know, or a Warren Commission. Like, how could this happen? We didn't have that. For the press portion of that failure, which was only one failure, I mean, the CIA got corrupted. Right. You know, everybody in the Defense Department that's supposed to be able to tell leadership, this is the reality, they failed, right? Civil servants fail. Lots of people fail. But we didn't have any sort of accounting. The New York Times did do a mea culpa. It's good for them. It's way more than most did. The Washington Post did an accounting of how its reporting got wrong. And that's it. The networks to this day have never said there was any problem with their reporting. All the other news organizations, zero. NPR, nothing. So there never really was an accounting of how could we get something like that wrong. And the reason this matters is not so that we can beat up on people who were misled. It's that there probably are structural reasons that a phony case for war pass through the Congress and the press and the other institutions of government. And after all, Chris, what is different about democracies as compared to authoritarian states or dictatorships? One of the most important things is governments have to give reasons for what they do. Right. Reason giving is at the heart, right, of democratic governance. And if you can give phony reasons for war, you can basically do anything. So it's not just a question of like bad professional practice or making the wrong judgment in a judgment call situation. It's that the institutions of an open society failed hugely. And there's probably a reason, and the reason has something to do with the drift of practice over a long period of time in those institutions.
There's a contrast, though, that's got to be drawn with the post-Vietnam moment. Maybe we didn't learn those lessons, but J. William Fulbright, I've just been rereading that story. He conducted incredibly searching hearings on how we got into that blunder, and he had voted for it, remember? Mm-hmm. He was not, you know, with Senator Greening and a few others that said, no way. But he went deep into it with the military, with the intelligence folk. I mean, Senator Church was unearthing the whole intelligence mess at the same time. And of course, his most famous star witness was that broken soldier, John Kerry, who had thrown his medals away and left us that line, you know, who's going to be the last man to die for a mistake? That was before the Foreign Relations Committee and Senator Fulbright.
The Church Committee.
Yes.
Later.
Yes.
But similar.
But John Kerry is now the chairman of Fulbright's committee.
Yeah.
And I keep waiting. And, of course, he voted yes, voted no, didn't know what the hell he was doing on Iraq. I wonder why he's not leading an inquiry. I mean, I'm talking months of testimony and analysis and coverage and discussion. But we're talking about the press.
Well, you know what strikes me as the real mystery here is that what actually happened, which is the point of having hearings like that, right, to determine what actually happened, for some reason, and I think this is the mystery part, has less force today than it once did. Mm. It's not that nobody ever ignored reality before or that we were all such empirical creatures at one time and now we're not. It's not like that. But for some reason, the actual record, what happened, has got less weight today than it did. It's just easier for it to just disappear and for everyone to go on as if we don't know or we never found out. Or our fairy tales were still true, or you know the case was still solid, and then I think how did reality get weaker? is to me like that is the mystery, and it's such a mystery that even the way I just formulated it, how did reality get weaker? I mean that sounds pathetic, you know that's really pathetic, but it's the best we can do because it's such an elusive question. That's what I see underneath Jutt's laments is that we haven't learned how to deal with this very strange weakening of reality.
I think Tony Jutt would say it goes even deeper to a decline in equality in America, the rise of the super rich, very political super rich, and that faith-based conversation, I think it was Karl Rove, speaking, meant it's just a name for propaganda, a propaganda of a ruling class that is disemboweling the wealth of the country. I mean, one of the alternatives in the reality-based community would have been to talk reality. Go out and find it, report it, and shove it down Karl Rove's throat. Mm-hmm. That response doesn't seem to have been considered. But how could we? How might we? Tell, you know, you right. run the politics, and we'll tell you about the country. It always reminds me of Spiro Agnew's attack on the press, the elite, unelected manipulators, blah, blah, blah. And Gene McCarthy responded wonderfully, turning Voltaire upside down. He said, I agree with every word you're saying, but I'll fight to the death against your right to say it. Sort of, we're in the reality business in the press. You guys run the manipulative politics all you want, but we're going to go out and find the truth and tell it. Right. And it seems to me that's what Tony Jutt is doing.
Well, what it would take is a very, very clear and continuous attempt to show what's changed, you know, in America, starting with income inequality, but many other things, and insisting on what we know about it. David Leonhardt, the really excellent economics correspondent for the New York Times, one of our best journalists, who is now the Washington Bureau chief of the New York Times, before he left his columnist job to take on this new responsibility, published this very interesting piece called What We Know. And it was Leonhardt setting down some things that his own reporting had told him are definitely true and shouldn't be argued out of existence by anybody. And one of them was, for example, income inequality has gotten a lot worse. We shouldn't have to argue about that because it is true. Another one, incidentally, for people in my business was higher education still helps you a lot. Go to school because that's going to make your life better. There's so much data to support it that we should just say it's true. Right? And he had like four or five other things like that. But the reality is that every single one of those things now is contested as if it weren't true in the news pages that he is editing in the Washington Bureau or the New York Times. In other words, he can't make his own convictions stick. He can't report as if things that are nailed down are true because contesting them is good politics.
Yeah.
And it is part of the reality of Washington, right? And so I don't think our interpreters, our journalists have figured out how to cope with that. When Obama says, you know, it's not exactly equivalent here, the kinds of battles we've had, and it's your job to figure that out, they in their hearts, they probably know that he's got a point, but they don't they can't manage the practice of it. And so there we are.
I love your point about David Leonard's point about the real value of an education. The story that we haven't heard, though, is that at the price of education today, fewer and fewer people can get it. And that we still think of ourselves as kind of land-grant college country and the GI Bill, that where education keeps expanding the middle class, as it did for my family. What we're not hearing is that it's turned. The price of education and the poverty in the middle class, fewer and fewer people can afford the ticket to middle class well-being. I mean, there's an instance of exactly what you're talking about. We're in a loop where so much of the news in the news business is about the news business and its distress. I mean, Murdoch's coming down, but then, so who's going to be the new Murdoch? Mm. It's not like, wait a sec, let's check our fundamental principles.
Yeah.
Well, this is another problem that's really interested me. We have people who are supposed to tell us the big story, but we have these stories that are almost too big. Like we have too big to fail. We have things that are too big to tell.
Amen.
In that the consequences, the implications of them are so large that they call into question the institutions that are normally involved in the telling. That's a big problem. If the middle class now is getting poorer, that's not just a story. That's a story that undoes the American dream, right?
Amen.
If the press failed the country, that's not just a study, a mea culpa. That's an institution that is somehow misaligned to its purpose. Right? If the financial system didn't just have a bubble, but a complete meltdown of accountability, that's not just a story. That's this institution doesn't work anymore, right? And I think we have so many of those things where this institution doesn't work anymore that our conversation is as much about protecting us from that as it is revealing those conditions. Now, the fact that we have all these new players, you know, from bloggers to social media to new institutions, young people who don't think like people like you and me, it means that we actually have more chatter about it. We have people who are kind of aware of it, but that's where the disconnect happened. That's where it's not getting through, you know. The narrative that governs the country still hasn't taken into account these massive failures of institutional responsibility. And so the problem is being solved by just increasing everybody's cynicism.
I remember a Nieman journalism conference in which Norman Mailer made a star appearance, and people were begging him, you know, as a creative writer, as a great, great journalist, sort of, Norman, how do you change the narrative? This was right after Dan Rather and CBS and Cy Hirsch had broken the Abu Ghraib story. Mm-hmm. And even that didn't break the narrative of that war.
It's way beyond the ability of a heroic narrator to do it for us. I don't see how that is going to happen.
We all know Orwell's warning in The Politics of the English Language that, you know, the corruption in the language betrays a corruption in the whole. Tony Judd's way of putting it is that if we don't talk differently, we won't think differently, and we won't act differently either. So start the engines, Jay. Where do we go from here? And especially deal with your point. When I barely knew you, Jay, you were a great champion of civic journalism, bottom-up journalism. It was a kind of call that the established media sort of ignored until the internet came along and gave people the device. In the meantime, your dream of civic media has come to being as social media. What's the difference and what's the promise in all that?
Well, when I was writing about civic journalism, the tools of the press were still in the hands of the media. And so the best you could hope for was that the professionals who operated those tools might here and there listen a little bit more to people outside their institution. But now the situation has completely changed because the tools of the press have themselves been distributed to the population at large. And in addition to that, this very strange conditions that people lived in during the age of mass media, where they were connected up to big media continuously in a one-way fashion, but disconnected from one another, atomized, has been overcome, decisively overcome, by social media. Social media is not about what I had for lunch. It's adding the horizontal to the previously potent vertical element of communication, right? So instead of people just being integrated vertically, meaning connected from their home to CNN and the State of the Union, right? They are now, still connected to CNN, still connected to the State of the Union, still connected to the Oscars, the Academy Awards, but they're also continuously talking horizontally to one another. It's not just that they can publish a blog, that's part of it. It's not just that they have a voice and can talk back, that's part of it. But it's more that social life kind of surrounds and overtakes media life. So that's a very different situation.
Can I say I find value in it too? I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook, but a little bit every day, you scan 100 entries, and it's like walking through a town that you know pretty well. You see, oh, so-and-so is drunk again. Oh, somebody sobered up. Somebody read a great book. Somebody heard, you know, saw a great movie, and they're telling you about it. Somebody had a baby, et cetera. And you get a sense of the country, the village life. People put on their best faces, but you get a lot of good vibes, which you used to get from a good hometown newspaper on the web. And I want to take note of that.
Yeah. Well, but I think it goes even beyond that, Chris, because one of the most powerful things that can happen to somebody, is often it's a politicizing moment, is when someone discovers that they're not alone in what they think. Yeah. Right? I mean, what is more mobilizing than that? Mm. Right? I thought I was the only one who was as dissatisfied, but I'm not, right? So social media is that. Oh, continuously, again and again, is you finding you're not only are you not alone, but thousands and millions of people feel the same way or as angry as you are. And what's changed is that media now is received in that socially connected environment.
Meetup used to quote that Timothy Leary slogan, find the others. And in a certain way, the web really does help.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of describing it. It radically reduces the costs of finding the others.
Yeah, Jay, we're talking about a big disconnect and a country that we all know is in some sort of trouble. I have to quote that Tony Judt line, we need to act upon our intuitions of impending catastrophe. I mean, get the numbers, get the facts, but still trust your gut in a certain way. He also said we have to theorize our better instincts, which is, I hope, what we're talking about. But to sum it up, we're talking about a major disconnect. Is this the end of something, do you think, or the beginning of something?
I would say the end in this sense. The only real program for change we have now is collapse, because we have these institutions that don't work. They are in many ways constructed on illusions or lies. They go until the day that they don't. Right? Like the whole mortgage finance-fueled financial system, right? It worked. It worked, it worked, it worked, it worked. And then one day, it collapsed with a lot of destruction and almost a kind of violence. We're now in a period where we can't reform. And so we're waiting for various forms of collapse. Now, in the aftermath, sometimes that can be the start of something. But I don't see right now any alternative to that. I don't think the institutions that are supposed to be able to take account of reality, name it, frame it, allow for a contest of ideas, permit a choice of large directions to be made, right? And therefore allow us to find some sort of imperfect remedy just don't work. And so the alternative to that is collapse. But in the collapse, there are new tools. There are new ideas. There's another generation, certainly not going to be you and me. And so there's where the case for optimism is. And we still need people like Judd. We need writers who, just trying to make sense of their own experience, can name and frame and describe what they see. But the tools for ignoring those people roar. They are powerful too.
Thank you so much. You're an example of the best kind of conscience, alert, detailed, always interesting out there. Thank you so much.